Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Fiske Engineering versus SPM ThermoShield. For the appellant, SPM is Mr. Jonathan Ustra, is that correct, sir? Attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee is Mr. Michael Lewis, an attorney also from Rapid City. Justice Sabers has disqualified himself on this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Lori Wilbur, the presiding judge of the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Sabers' place. Excuse me. Mr. Ustra, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Counsel Lowe's. My name is John Ostra. I'm an attorney at the Gunderson Palmer Law Firm in Rapid City, South Dakota, and I'm appearing today on behalf of SPM ThermoShield Incorporated, who I'd like to refer to as ThermoShield. ThermoShield is requesting this court's review of a decision by the circuit court confirming an award rendered by an arbitrator and denying our request to have that award vacated. There are two issues I'd like to focus on this morning. The first is the authority of the arbitrator. I will be asking this court to recognize that the plain and unambiguous terms of a contract must control, and that an arbitrator is not free to disregard those plain and unambiguous terms. And if the arbitrator does that, then he or she has exceeded the authority that's been provided to them. And then second, I want to focus on the actual terms of the contract at issue here, because it is my burden to establish that this contract can only be interpreted in one manner, and that the circuit court erred in their interpretation of the contract. I would like to give a very brief statement of the facts of this case. The history of this matter is very long, but there's only a very small portion of this history of this case that's relevant to the issues that are before the court today. There was a distributorship contract entered into between my client, ThermoShield, and Fiske Engineering, which I'd like to refer to as Fiske, in 1994. There are addendums to the contract, but the actual 1994 contract includes the provisions that are issued today. One of those provisions is in paragraph 10, and it says, on termination of this agreement, neither company nor distributor shall be liable to each other for compensation, reimbursement, or damages. And then it goes on to talk about lost profits, anticipated sales, expenditures and investments, and there's a catch-all provision that says, on account of any other cause whatsoever. There's also an exception built into this paragraph. It says, except for goods previously sold under this agreement and indebtedness then owing. Paragraph 8 is the other paragraph that's at issue today. And it says, this agreement shall continue in force until canceled or terminated, and continues on to say that the cancellation or termination required a material breach of the terminated party.
Are those provisions in conflict? Do you think that the provision in 8 that says there has to be material breach and the provision in 10 that says any other cause?
I don't think that they are. I think that they obviously the whole contract needs to be read together, but I think that paragraph 10 is very clear. Paragraph 10 says upon termination, and the word termination in that paragraph is not limited in any sense. So it's our argument that termination includes any termination, whether the termination is for cause or the termination is not for cause. The parties were two sophisticated businessmen that signed this agreement, and they understood how to define terms. I mean, if you look at paragraph 1 of the contract, they defined the word ThermoShield products specifically. They didn't specifically define the word termination. And so it's our argument that termination has to apply to, I mean, the word applies to all terminations, whether it's right or wrong. The parties all...
The word all is not in there, obviously. And I know it is in some of the one federal district court case that that's been talked about in the briefs, where a district judge found that it was on unambiguous. But I noticed that contract said, you know, any termination or all terminations or something like that. This contract doesn't have that.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. But again, it's not limited either. I mean, it says upon termination. And I recognize it doesn't say all termination, but it says on termination. And, you know, it's our argument that that includes, that has to include every termination. I think that if it only applies, and what the circuit court said is you can disregard the you can disregard the terms. Well, if you have, if you don't, if the termination is not for cause, then you disregard paragraph 10. And you know, it's our argument that that is simply incorrect, because I think that if you, if the clause, if paragraph 10 only applies when a termination is for cause, then what you, I mean, the only way you can get there is you have to read an exception into the agreement. You have to read language into the agreement that's not there. You have to read the language. I mean, you have to either read, you have to either read it to say upon termination for cause, or you have to add an exception to the end. And this contract doesn't have either.
Doesn't the court, I mean, haven't the courts, though, generally deferred to the arbitrator in interpreting these contracts?
That's correct.
So why would we want to get involved in this at this point?
There is deference to the arbitrator, and we can't disagree with that. And we also recognize that the authority of the arbitrator is broad. But the cases also recognize that authority is not unlimited, and the cases also recognize that the deference is not absolute. I mean, if the deference was absolute, then there effectively would be no judicial review of an arbitrator's decision.
Isn't that the theory behind arbitration?
It is, in to the extent that, I mean, I think part of the reason that parties go to arbitration is obviously to let a third party decide. But that being said, if you have an instance where the arbitrator has disregarded the plain meaning of the contract, if you have an instance where the arbitrator has, and in the cases used the words, you know, use their own brand of industrial justice, I mean, they can't just simply do whatever they want to do. I mean, there has to be some constraints. They have to apply the terms of the contract that are before them.
But they can, well, they can misinterpret the contract, and still we are required to defer to that, aren't we? It has to be something far beyond just misinterpretation.
That's correct.
If we say, all right, we will look at the contract and we will look at the construction that the arbitrator put on it, are we not in effect simply opening up the door anytime the arbitration concerns a contract and saying, well, it's a final decision of the arbitrator, but we'll take a look at the contract and make the ultimate legal decision? Aren't we basically just paying lip service at that point to the theory that arbitration is a final resolution of a dispute? Where do we draw the line?
I don't think that, I mean, if the court can't review it, then an arbitrator's decision is, I mean, the arbitrator's authority is basically unlimited. Now, I think that in this case, it would be very narrow, and it would be, I mean, and there's numerous, you know, federal court opinions out there where it is very narrow. I mean, you're looking at just this contract, and you're saying in this specific instance, we believe that the arbitrator did what he could not do. And so I think that the holding would be, I mean, it's very limited. It's very narrow because it only applies to this specific instance.
But is it really narrow? Because, as you know, virtually every contract case we ever have up here, and every statutory dispute we have, there's always an argument if the court's divided about what's the plain meaning, and then the other camp is, well, no, if you construe this and this, then it means this. So it seems to me that when you raise this kind of an argument, if we were following up on what the chief said, if we're to follow your suggestion here, there's going to be no line to be drawn, because everyone's going to argue, well, this is plain meaning. The other side's going to say, no, you have to look at this paragraph together with this paragraph. And so I don't know that we have a line.
And I recognize your concern, but I respectfully disagree. I mean, I think that you have to be able to look to see what did the arbitrator do, and if the arbitrator did something, if their decision so directly contradicts the contract that the parties entered, the contract that they are bound by, then there has to be some mechanism where the court can say, okay, now we defer, and your authority is broad, but it's not unlimited.
What would you do then in an instance? I realize that arbitrators don't have to say why they're ruling. But you can just say, oh, Judge Martin or Arbitrator Martin could have just said, Spitzer wins, Thermoshield loses. Signed, Gene Martin. Can we go behind that too then? Or are we only looking at this because Martin said why he made his decision?
Well, I think at any time you can take a look at the decision, whether it's a reasoned opinion or whether it's a very brief, one sentence, or whether there's no, I mean, you can take a look and see what it is that the arbitrator did. And in this instance, the contract says clearly that there is no lost profits, that there is no anticipated sales, that you can't recover for these expenditures that Spitzka had in building up their territories in their investment. I mean, that's what the contract said. And so when you have an award, or when you have a contract that so specifically says no damages on termination, then if damages are awarded, then you can take a look at that and you can say, well, obviously the arbitrator disregarded the plain meaning of the contract. So I think that you can do it in either instance.
Clarify one thing for me in the record. I didn't quite understand the distinction that's being drawn here between the arbitrator apparently finding there was no material breach, yet there's a suggestion that it was wrongful, the termination was wrongful. Am I reading that wrong?
I think the decision is that the arbitrator's decision is that there was no material breach by Spitzka, and so that for that reason, then the termination
is wrong
by ThermoShield was wrongful.
Okay.
And that's a decision that we haven't challenged.
It's basically the paragraph 8 provision.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, Your Honor. And that's, you know, and because of the deference to the arbitrator, and because of the arbitrator's authority, I mean, that decision was based on the factual matters that were presented to the arbitrator. And so that's something that we really could not, that we did not feel we had any basis for challenging. But the award can be vacated if the arbitrator exceeds his authority. And I think it's clear if you look at the Eighth Circuit cases and if you look at the Supreme Court cases, there is a significant amount of law that says arbitrator cannot disregard the plain and unambiguous meaning. And so it's our argument that falls within, I mean, if the arbitrator does that, then they have, in essence, exceeded the authority that's provided to them. I think that, you know, what we're asking you to do is simply take a look at the contract and read the contract together, and then, you know, make the decision on whether or not this result can be reached from the arbitrator's decision. I mean, from the arbitrator. I mean, that's. I think this is a fairly narrow case, and I think you have to take a look at, well, you know, we need to look at what the intent is of the parties, and we look to the meaning, or we look to the words that they used. And again, the word termination is not limited in any sense. And so to get to the circuit court's conclusion, you have to add something to the contract. And we don't think that it's proper for the circuit court to do that, to add something to the contract.
What then we have, this is not just an arbitrator. I mean, this man is a lawyer. He's been a judge for decades. Are you saying his decision is irrational?
Essentially, yes. I mean, I think that if you disregard, and with all due respect to the arbitrator, but if you disregard the plain and unambiguous terms of the contract, then your decision does not draw its essence from the terms of the contract itself. And so, in a sense, I think it would be an irrational decision.
And then, of course, by definition, Judge Davis was irrational, too. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I simply don't think that the contract can be interpreted in that way. And you know, that is the core of our argument, that you absolutely cannot interpret the contract that way.
What about our language that says the standard review is if it's even arguably a matter of interpretation, we have to defer. Now we've got, if we all go one way, the vote's going to be 5-2 on lawyers looking at the, well, no, it's going to be 6-3, I guess, on whether it's arguably a matter of interpretation.
And I can't, I mean, I understand that the deferential standard. I mean, I think it has to be so clear under the terms of the contract that the arbitrator rewrote the contract. Now, if you look at the Boyce case, the Boyce Cascade case that we cited, there's a footnote in there that says we recognize that the arbitrator, you know, if he arguably construed the contract, then it was acting within his authority, then we have to follow the decision of the arbitrator. But it also says that if it's clear that the arbitrator rewrote the terms of the contract, or you know, used their own brand of industrial justice, or and exceeded their authority, then you can't say that it was arguably construed and applied. I don't think that you can simply have an arbitrator say, "I read the contract, and here is my award," and that be final. I mean, if that was the case, if that was all it took, then the award would basically have an unlimited authority, because there's nothing that we could do. If he said, you know, and that's, if he, all he had to say was, "I read the contract, here's my award," then, you know, the arbitrator's authority is basically unlimited in that instance, and we don't think that's the case.
What's left to arbitrate if you read Section 10 the way that I think you're intending that we should read it?
I think that there would have been numerous issues that could have been arbitrated. First of all, the issue that was arbitrated, whether there was a wrongful termination of the contract. And if there was no cause to terminate, then under the terms of the contract, because there's no damages available, then under the terms of the contract, the termination was not effective, and then SPISCA would have their rights reinstated underneath the contract. They just get the same rights back. There also could have been other issues with regard to shipments of the product, payments, disputes over the territories that were involved. I mean, there are, you know, a full range of issues that could have been that could have been arbitrated.
In your view, are any of the damages that were awarded by the arbitrator covered by the exception to Section 10?
I think that all of the damages fall within Exception 10. I think the only question would be the issue of attorney's fees.
To follow up on Judge Wilbur's questioning, then, I guess when I read the briefs for both sides, it was my understanding either one or you lost. No remand. Are you saying now that if you get a reversal or remand is necessary, or that you owe nothing?
Well, as I was preparing for this, I don't think that, I think that all of the damages fall within the Section 10. And the only issue that I was thinking about last night was that the fact that under the terms of the contract, the arbitrator or Spisco would have been a prevailing party on Issue 1. And under the terms of the contract, attorney's fees were available to the prevailing party. Now, I'll be honest with you, I hadn't thought of that before, and I didn't research the issue of, you know, how that would happen. I mean, if you prevail on one issue but not on another issue, you know, do you get your attorney's fees for the entire award? I simply don't. I'm so interested for the entire amount. I simply don't know the answer to that.
Section 10 lets allows damages for goods previously sold and indebtedness then owing. And so you're saying that none of those damages, especially I'm looking at Spisco expenditures from 95 to 2000 for 831,000, those don't encompass goods previously sold or?
I don't think so. And I'll qualify that by saying I don't know what was presented to the arbitrator. I didn't represent ThermoShield during the arbitration. There is no record from the arbitration, but I believe that I'm over my time.
Complete your answer.
Okay. I believe, though, that amount referred to dollar amounts that they would have spent in preparing their territories or building up their territories, getting certification for their products in those different territories.
So we don't really know whether any of those damages awarded by the arbitrator are included in the exception to Section 10, based on what you're telling us.
I think
there is no record, because the parties didn't ask for a record.
I think that's a fair statement.
Or they didn't ask for a reasoned decision.
I think that's a fair statement, but I think that they fall either within the provision talking about expenditures, because it says no expenditures, or it falls within the catch-all.
Thank you, counsel.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Luce, you have 20 minutes. And if you wouldn't mind, before you get into your presentation, I'd like you to address a question we just ended with Mr. Ustra. Once again, my understanding when I read the briefs is either one or you lost, up or down. Do you agree with that, or do you think if there's a reversal or remand would be necessary?
I do agree with the Chief Justice on that point, and may it please the court and counsel. On the issue of remand, it strikes me that if the decision is to affirm the circuit court, confirming the arbitration award, obviously the case is done. If Judge Davis's decision failing to vacate or confirming the award is reversed, it strikes me that the parties have agreed that the issue of wrongful termination of the contract is not to be re-arbitrated. And by this court's finding of reversal on the issue of damages, I think that would end that particular inquiry as well.
Thank you.
So I don't think there would be anything to remand. Judge Wilbur's inquiry regarding the particular itemization of damages, I did represent the Spisco party at the arbitration. And in candor and fairness, I believe that the items that we requested for damages are not those items within the exception. Or if it was, it was a very small portion.
Thank you, counsel.
You're welcome. And just as a sort of introduction, I am Mike Lose. I represent Spisco. I am here before the court to echo the Chief Judge's Justice's concern, and that shared by Justice Zinter, that adopting the ThermoShield position in this case would dangerously undermine the effectiveness of arbitration, which has long been favored by both the legislature and this court. And to piggyback on the Chief Justice's concern, particularly in cases involving contracts or contract interpretation, which comes before arbitrators virtually on a daily basis, because of the standard of review of contract interpretation, it would be, to use the Chief Justice's word, merely lip service to speak of the benefits of arbitration and the deference that courts show arbitrators' decision to say that we can reinterpret contracts, because it's a de novo review. And as the court is well aware, if an arbitrator makes a decision, the appeal, so to speak, is to a circuit court who would have de novo review of contract interpretation, as would this court of a circuit court's decision. And it's irreconcilable with the stated principle that arbitration is supposed to be a reasonably inexpensive and quick process, that the courts have little oversight other than to ensure that the process itself was conducted in a fair manner. And frankly, this case is something of a poster child for that concept. We're now over 7 years after my client was wrongfully terminated from these various agreements that he had with the folks at ThermoShield. We've had two arbitrations. We've had one court trial and one court hearing, and now we're here before this honorable court for the second time. And for sophisticated businessmen that entered into a dispute resolution procedure that is supposed to be inexpensive and quick, that has certainly fallen short, unfortunately.
I will invite you to tell me why Arbitrator Martin and Judge Davis were not irrational.
They were not irrational, Your Honor. If you could indulge me just one brief side comment.
Sure.
I believe part of the inquiry needs to be, and it wasn't addressed by Mr. Ostra, you know, sort of what framework are we working in here? Because South Dakota statutes regarding vacating arbitration awards are slightly different than those applied under the Federal Arbitration Act. And so just as a very brief caveat to the Chief Justice's question, I'm not sure that this court has ever recognized that, I'm missing the language, but this completely irrational decision is a grounds for vacating an award. I mean, I think we need to start with the idea that it's ThermoShield's burden to identify what's the hook. I mean, what provision of the vacating arbitration award statutes are we talking about? But presuming that we're talking about this 21, 25A, 24 sub 3 exceeding the arbitrator's powers, I mean, assuming we're dealing with that, it's not clear that the court has adopted the irrational decision language. But assuming that it has, paragraph 8 and paragraph 10 of the agreements, I believe, require that, and we may not, we may as well not guess what the language is, because I think the language is important. Paragraph 8 says that either party may cancel or terminate this agreement at any time upon a material breach by the other party, paren, including but not limited to illegal activities, misrepresentation of product warranties, comma, etc., end paren, end quote. So in the legal vernacular, what we've got is a for-cause termination provision only, and paragraph 10, which purports to limit damages on termination, can really only make sense if we're talking about just sort of the parties mutually agreeing, you know, We're done. And if the parties mutually agree that we're concluding our business, then it makes sense that there would be no damages. Why would there be damages if legally and mutually the parties say the contract is over or the contracts are over? But in the instance of a illegal, wrongful termination, all bets are off. In the language of Judge Davis, the arbitrator wasn't constrained by any limitation of damages provision once you make the affirmative finding, now undisputed, that the contract between my client and ThermoShield was wrongfully, illegally terminated. And just speak to Justice Zinter's inquiry, and I believe Mr. Oster properly characterized it. The issue of material breach came up because, as was shown by the arbitrator's decision to be a pretext, ThermoShield offered various reasons why it terminated these various franchise rights of my client. The arbitrator, upon hearing the case, said that there was no material breach, that the breach of the agreement was a pretext for, I mean, the short version is greed, and at that point, you've got a wrongful termination. So material breach was sort of proffered as a reason to terminate the contracts. There being no material breach, the only other explanation is it was illegally terminated. And as long as we're looking at the contracts, I think it's important to also refer to paragraph 30, which speaks to what is the arbitrator's authority. What have these sophisticated businessmen, as Mr. Oster described, what have they agreed is going to be subject to arbitration? Paragraph 30 states, quote, "In the event of any dispute between the parties, such dispute will be arbitrated according to the AAA rules." And that's important for this reason, Your Honors. In conjunction with the idea that we need to, or this court in its analytical framework needs to figure out, are we applying SDCL 2125A24 or something else, or some version of that plus common law, this court in the Double Diamond case, that was an arbitration case involving a construction dispute, described the analytical framework for how does the court look at cases where a, quote, an arbitrator, quote, exceeded his or her powers. And the court said, in deciding whether an arbitrator has exceeded his power, the court need only look at or need only examine the submission, that is, what did the parties put forth to the arbitrator, and examine the award and determine if the award conforms to the submission. So let's look at what was submitted to the arbitrator in this case, and it starts with paragraph 30. All disputes are going to be submitted. In particular, and the Double Diamond case points this out, the importance of a party's position paper, the court described it in that case, is important to determine what was submitted. So in this case, and we've attached it to our brief, the ThermoShield folks identified an issue of contract interpretation. They said there are two key provisions to this contract that are important in the arbitrator's decision, one of them being a purported limitation of damages. And so they've agreed to arbitrate all disputes. They've identified a dispute as being the interpretation of the contract. Judge Martin then, in his award, although not a memorandum type of a reasoned decision, at least in recital form, says, I've reviewed the contracts you've asked me to review. I find a wrongful termination and award damages. So under the analytical framework of Double Diamond, I think it's clear that the issue was submitted, and it's almost like a flow chart. You know, if we find that the issue was submitted to the arbitrator and the award confirms the submission, it's, the box says stop. I mean, there's no further judicial examination.
Well, that'd be a little bit of an oversimplification in a case where everyone agreed that the arbitrator did something that the contract prohibited, plainly prohibited.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair, Justice Zinner. And really, in my preparation for our time together today, it strikes me that we certainly agree, that is, the parties agree to maybe more than we disagree. I mean, the ThermoShield position is that if there is any version of interpretation of the contract, that's the end of the inquiry. if it was even arguably construed, as Your Honor referenced earlier. If it was even arguably construed, that's the end of the inquiry. There's no review of interpretation. And that's, again, consistent with why sophisticated businessmen, or unsophisticated, or anybody, would choose arbitration. You give up certain rights in exchange for purported benefits of quicker, reasonably, and reasonably less expensive. But, you know...
But my point was, you can't just say it's over because a court looks at it and sees that the arbitrator said, I read the contract, or I construed the contract, or interpreted. I mean, it's got to go a little bit more than that.
I agree, and I agree completely. And in this case, the record bears out that it goes well beyond that. It goes well beyond that because the parties agreed to arbitrate all disputes. ThermoShield raised the issue of contract interpretation and whether damages were awardable in a case. Judge Martin indicated that he considered that, reviewed the contracts, and made his decision. So I would certainly ask that this court affirm Judge Davis, who confirmed the award of Judge Martin, as being certainly well within his authority, well within his powers. And finally, bring this case to an end. And unless the court has further questions, I have nothing further.
Well, I have one. Was this contract essentially forever? I mean, if the only termination is for material breach, if you don't have that, was it to continue forever?
Potentially, Your Honor. You know, it's not in the record, but I mean, I can speak to the idea that ThermoShield products are being sold in these territories now. I mean, right now. It could just as well be my client receiving the benefit. But I think there is an implied in the contract is the parties can mutually agree to end their business. It can't be unilaterally ended absent just cause. I mean, I think that's the fair reading of the contract.
Thank you.
It's been an honor appearing before the court, and I thank you for your time.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early. Thank you. Mr. Ooster, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And I'd just like to address a few of the comments that Mr. Loos made, and I'll start with Justice Zinter's question on the last question on was this contract forever. There is a provision in the contract that says they could both decide to mutually terminate it. But essentially, without that, it could go on forever, as Mr. Loos indicated. And what the parties did here is they chose to limit all their damages upon termination. I mean, that is what they chose to do. And the Coca-Cola Teamsters case, it's 959 Fed Second 1438, says the language of the agreement is clear and unambiguous, and since the parties agreed to it, they are bound by it. I mean, they are bound by the terms of their contract. Now, Mr. Loos also referenced the framework of which we're presenting this case, whether it's under SDCL 2125. This case is different than the ASCON case, the Double Diamond case. In those cases, the issue was, I mean, when you're talking about the authority under the South Dakota statute, the power of the arbitrator, you know, they're looking at exactly what issues were presented. You know, issue one, issue two, that type of thing. I don't know if there's anything in the record that says, you know, exactly which issue, like that this issue of whether or not the damage limitation applied was an issue before the arbitrator. That being said,
weren't there submissions made in writing to the arbitrator so we could look at what the record reflected in those written submissions?
You're correct, and that's what I was just going to say. There is one reference that I'm aware of that says that there are no, I mean, it's just a statement, I think, more than anything. Just says there are no, just want the arbitrator to know that there's no damages available. That being said, though, we haven't brought this in the framework of, you know, what were the issues presented. We brought it more in the framework of that it exceeds the authority of an arbitrator, it exceeds the power of an arbitrator if you disregard the plain and unambiguous terms of the contract. And that principle comes more from the federal cases. But I think, though, that if an arbitrator disregards the plain and unambiguous meaning of the contract, then what they've done is they've exceeded the authority that they've been given. And that has to fall then, and that can fall in within the South Dakota statutory framework.
Well, aren't we bound to follow the South Dakota statutory framework?
It's an interesting question, and it's a very good question. It's in the history of this case, we've argued back and forth, but it's never really been resolved. Are we under federal law or are we under South Dakota law? And the first decision was rendered basically under South Dakota law, but with reference to federal principles, as this court often does in arbitration cases. It takes guidance from federal principles. We made a motion to vacate under state law. SPISCA made their motion to confirm under state law, and then, you know, we've kind of moved forward here, and it's never really been resolved. I think I think the principles are pretty much the same under both. I think that the standards are pretty much the same. I think the difference is under federal law, there's a slew of cases that have recognized that the arbitrator acts beyond his or her authority when they disregard the plain meaning of the contract. And that's an issue that I don't think, that I'm not aware, has been presented to this court. Just in closing, it's our position that you can't reach the circuit court's result without adding an exception to the contract. I think the plain meaning is clear from the language. The intent is clear from the language of the contract. The damage limitation applies. This is the term that they put in. They're bound by it, and the award must be vacated. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Since we are also on the Internet, rather than taking a 10-minute recess, we will start at 10 o'clock. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.